Good morning. Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns. The nations rage, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress. Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolation on the earth. He makes wars cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress.
Thanks, Adam. Well, it's good to be back. I was away in Regina last week. I did a lock-in and preached there, and I always miss being here. But if you remember the last time I preached here, sorry, I also didn't sleep a lot, and so my voice is prepubescent. I don't see the connection between that, but last time I preached here, back to the point, Ryan was also service leading, and he asked, hey, aren't you guys excited to have Stephen preach? And some child, I think a Stroby kid, yelled out, no, he's boring. And so last week, I did a lock-in on Hosea in Regina, and the next day preached, and Ryan's brother Tony was service leading and said, who was at the lock-in? And half the people raised their hands, and he goes, did everyone like it? And some 11-year-old boy goes, no, it was boring. So, two things. Who brings 11-year-olds to a lock-in on Hosea? And who expects a Hosea lock-in to be really fun? I don't know, but also, I think in sharing a bedroom with Ryan and Tony through some teenage years, they actually know my goal, which is ultimately to bore children. So that's my goal today, is to bore children and preach the word. So if there's any kids here, I'm sorry, but that is my goal for today, is to bore you. But yeah, in keeping with Ryan's example from last week, we're going to depart from 1 Corinthians this week. Even though this text that I'm doing today isn't thematically too drastically far from the 1 Corinthians text, which is supposed to be on chapter 3, verses 10-11, but it felt like it was a timely and needed message for us. And so every week as a staff, we get together on Wednesdays for prayer and worship and a short meditation. And it was my turn to give the devotional, and I felt led to this passage, Psalm 46, and at the end, Lucille Akins suggested, oh, maybe you should share this on Sunday. And since I was already preaching, we thought, that's probably good. So if you don't like this and wish we were in 1 Corinthians 3, you can take that up with Lucille. We are entirely following her lead, and she seems really sweet, but she'll fight you. So, but it is a really, really beautiful passage, and for me, I think it's one that's really timely. I think it's timely for our church. And the way I came about this passage, like sometimes you think God's revelation has to be super spiritual. I was just like browsing through Facebook one day, and a prof of mine, a post of his from 2012, oddly enough, came up on my feed, and it just had some like little nerdy comment about one of the words in this passage, and it really struck me, and it felt like it gave me a better understanding of the purpose of this passage, and so I've been meditating on it for weeks, and so if it's prophetic, if it's relevant, we'll trust the sovereignty of God in making this pop up on my Facebook feed, but it was not some like mystical supernatural experience, so we can thank Facebook or blame Facebook for this at the end. But this psalm, it's just beautiful, and it's divided up into three kind of stages. These stages don't really transition that well. It's kind of three different themes throughout it, and the transitions are actually abrupt and somewhat jarring, and they're meant to be that way. But we see in the first three verses, the first stage is this like cosmic attack on Zion, the mount of God, the city of God, the people of God. And then the next stage is God's ultimate safety. And then finally, God's counterattack, that God is actually going to come and defend. And so the first stage, it really deals with this like profoundly cosmic battle. And though there's this really strong attack against Zion, it starts, I think, appropriately with this. God is our refuge and strength. He is a very present, you could also translate it as a well-proved help in trouble. That God is fundamentally our refuge. He is our strength. He is well-proved. His faithfulness has been proven, and it's present especially in times of trouble. That God alone is refuge. God alone is our strength. And there's many places in the world we can find refuge. There is lots of places to find strength. But God alone is the epitome of refuge. He is the epitome of strength. He is the epitome of safety. And the psalmist provides this level of assuredness that God is and will continue to be that for his people amid some of the biggest attacks they could face. That intrinsically, he is who he is, and he is safety. He defines strength. He defines refuge. And that if we actually believe that, that matters. Actually believing that God is strength, and God is safety, and God is refuge actually makes a difference in my life. And I love that the ESV says present can also be well proved. And that he just isn't near us. He's not just with us, and he's safe because he's with us, but there's a sense of he is consistently, for all time, proven over and over and over again of his faithfulness, that he is incredibly dependable, and that he is our refuge. And so when you reflect on that, the Old Testament is consistently reminding Israel that God is the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that it is God who brought them out of the land of Egypt. Like, it's this constant refrain all through the Old Testament of them reminding themselves of the faithfulness of God, reminding themselves of his well-proved care for them. And I just generally don't have that enough. I don't constantly remind myself of God's past faithfulness. And then when trial comes up, I quickly end up looking the other way. But this verse challenges me to remind myself that actually he is a well-proved refuge. He is well-proven to be strong and mighty and to defend me. And so I love that the Israelites just get this aspect of God, and I felt over the weeks to just remind myself of that, to just recount all of the things he's done for me, for my family, for my parents, for my grandparents, and that he has proven himself over and over again. And even if he hadn't, like the reality of salvation in some ways should frame this for us, that he has already proven to us in our union with him that he is for us, that he's good to us, that he defends us, that he is our refuge, and he is our strength. And so we see in the text that God can be counted on, that his strength, it's meant to show that it surpasses anything that we can conceive, and that has to be the foundation of all of our lives and all of our beliefs, because inevitably, we'll have to rely on him, we'll have to lean on him, and if we think he isn't strong, then we're hesitant to lean on him. And so the nature of this attack in this psalm is really, really powerful. It is cosmic. And in some ways, I think we have to use our imaginations when we read it to actually understand the scope of what's being communicated. Because we read this figurative language all the time, and I think it loses some of its impact. But the psalmist continues, therefore, as in, because we know God is well-proved, because we know he's steadfast, because we know he's a place of refuge, because we know he is protection, and he is inherently profoundly strong, therefore we will not fear, though the earth gives way, though the mountains be moved into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains tremble at its swelling. Like, this is an intense picture. That we know that God is our safety. We know that God is our strength. And even though the entirety of the earth is giving way, like just actually think about it, even though the earth is completely falling apart, like everything is crumbling under the chaos that's happening, that the waters of the sea are rising to the point of covering mountaintops, that mountains aren't being thrown into the sea, but the sea is completely and utterly surrounded the mountains as though now the mountains are in the middle of the sea. That the sea has advanced, the mountains have gone into it, the waters are going absolutely insane, the waves are crashing, the waters are roaring and foaming, and everything on the earth, the mountains of the earth, are trembling beneath the raging of the water. So if you think about what he's trying to communicate, like the earth and all of creation is just falling apart and coming apart at its seams. There is nothing that can even be counted on. It's meant to show us something that is utterly terrifying, and creation is just falling apart. The world is falling apart. And so whatever is causing his reflection has this kind of magnitude to it. There is an attack at bay that's making him feel like everything he knows is coming apart at its seams. It's not some like meteorological, however you say that, absurdity. Like it isn't like just nature is going crazy. It's meant to evoke emotion. It's meant to show us that there is something really chaotic that's happening, that the core of who he is coming apart. And so whenever you read the Old Testament, you always have to know water is representative of chaos. In the ancient Near East, they viewed water and earth as different spheres. People didn't belong in water. Water was terrifying. Water was deified as something evil, something supernatural, and it was meant to show chaos and a destruction of the ordinary. And mountains were actually meant to show some form of stability. So you can find online these pictures of how the Israelites viewed the world, and this is not an endorsement of the flat earth, but you have waters above, waters below, and waters obviously the seas, but the mountains functioned as pillars of the earth that kept the waters above at bay, but they also sunk down below the waters below and held up the earth. So everything they know and everything they believed is kind of held stable by these mountains. That mountains represent stability in many different forms. Water represents chaos. So the psalmist is looking around and he sees in his life, and probably the whole life of Israel, this reality of chaos coming against them and their life falling apart. That everything they would view as stable, everything they could depend on, everything that could potentially hold them up is trembling at the chaos that surrounds them. That the chaos and there's forces of evil against them. There's this internal sense and this external sense that there are forces that are opposed to the people of God. There are forces opposed to the purposes of God, and they're rising. And they're not rising slowly. They're rising really violently. They're rising quickly, and all of their stability is in some ways being overcome by this chaos. And so you read it and you go, life sucks for them. Like at this point, life is really, really bad. That the mountains they have viewed as stable, the mountains that they would view as high places, potential refuges, are no longer there. That chaos and instability has completely and utterly taken them down. Everything they know is no longer trustworthy. You get the sense that stability is gone, and what stability there was and what constant kind of things there was has just gone beneath the swelling adversity. And God allows this to happen. And in some ways, he allows our stable places to be shaken. He allows the places we would consider stable to be shaken. And as I was reflecting on this, I was reminded of a time in my life. I think it was 2011. I was part-time here and part-time installing granite. And I got in a car accident, really messed up my neck and my back, and had to quit doing granite. And so I was making roughly like probably $1,600 less per month than my bills and couldn't get a job at Starbucks. Like I applied to be a barista and they're like, no, you're not qualified to serve coffee. And it's not like Johnny Bean where it's good coffee, it's probably just like hit the button and it auto sets everything and makes coffee. And they thought, no, you are not capable of that. And so for a year, I couldn't find work and was making like $1,600 less per month than just my bills. And I eventually had to go, okay, Lord, like if your plan for me is to remove my ability to ever get debt, that's okay. Like, I thought, you're going to tank my credit score so bad, I'll never be able to get a credit card or a car loan or another mortgage, buy a new house. Like, I will have no stability other than you. I just knew this is within his wheelhouse to go, I'm going to remove everything that you could possibly rely on. And he didn't. It didn't happen that way, but I had to come to terms in my own heart that I look for ways other than God to produce stability in my own life. So I look to the ability to have a good credit score and a well-paying job to get myself out of a jam was a stability that I relied on. And so I thought, okay, maybe you don't want me to own a house. That has to be okay. Maybe you don't want me to have good enough credit to actually get myself out of a jam. Maybe you don't ever want me to buy or finance a car. And the reality is, through that time, I was given 7 different free cars. And so you could see in my own life this relying on things that weren't God, that these mountains that aren't inherently bad things, good credit score is a good thing, a good job is a good thing, being able to buy a car is a good thing, but I relied on those things to be my provision. And so in my life, in that year, the waters of chaos toppled over every one of those mountains. And so we see for them all of these mountains, all of these things that they would have viewed as stable, that they would have viewed as good things, are completely overrun and overcome by adversity. And yet, the resounding, God is our refuge and strength. God is our very present help in times of trouble. And I think that's the point. Sometimes the point of adversity, to get us to that place. And then the scene just abruptly ends. There's no more talk about this kind of cosmic attack against Zion. But the psalmist continues, "There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her when morning dawns." The shift is abrupt. That the mountain of Zion, we know Zion is considered a mountain, that it was a high place where the Israelites ascended to worship, that Zion cannot be shaken, that the Mount of Zion cannot be toppled by the waters of chaos, that the mountain of God can never be moved into the sea. And beautifully, Zion has its own waters. And we're meant to see this like total opposite, that the waters of the earth are chaotic. The waters of the earth are unstable. They bring about disorder. They bring about destruction. And in some ways, they're diametrically opposed to God's people. But the waters of God are of different nature. The waters of the earth can't move him. The waters of the earth can't remove him from his dwelling place. Zion won't be overcome, and even though every other mountain is overcome, even though every other source of stability has been removed, Zion and the dwelling place of God stands alone. And Zion stands triumphant. And its waters are different. Its waters are the same material, which I think is funny, that sometimes I found that really striking, that there's waters of chaos, and yet the waters of Zion are of the same substance, and yet have a profoundly different purpose, and a profoundly different beginning, and a profoundly different end. That Zion's waters bring about life. That Zion's waters flow directly from the mountain. They flow from God, and they bring stability, and they bring restoration, and they bring peace of God, and as Ryan preached, to the church and out from the church to the world around them. The substance is the same, but the source is so profoundly different. And the result of being in and tasting and dwelling in these waters is profoundly different for us. One is chaos and one is peace. And beautifully, God dwells in the midst of it. God dwells in the midst of his mountain. God dwells in the midst of Zion. And when chaos shakes every mountain of this earth, every mountain of our culture, every mountain of our lives, God does not desert. God does not leave. He does not flee, but he stays in the midst of his people. He stays in the midst of his city, and he makes his city glad. At this point, he's not making the waters go away, but his waters come, and his waters bring change, and his waters make people happy. They bring about the joy of heaven. And so I read it and just go, let's let the seas rage. Let's let the earth quake, because God is here. God is in his holy place. God is in his church. He is in Zion, and it doesn't matter what's coming against us, because he cannot be shaken. So let it happen. Let chaos try. And within me, there's this chaos that lives within me. And you guys may be like me. You may not be. But when adversity comes, it sometimes is to the point where it feels like everything in my life is coming apart at its seams. Everything could fall apart. That I am profoundly aware of my own propensity to sin, and the impact of that sin sometimes produces a chaos that I cause. I'm aware of my own inabilities. I'm aware of my insecurities. I'm aware of my pain. And all of those things combined make me feel chaotic inside. The waters of chaos sometimes are rising up to the point that I feel like I can't breathe, that everything within me is shaking and trembling. Yet God is my refuge and strength. God dwells in the midst of his people, and his waters bring about life. And in this passage, you can see that coming up, there is a real external threat as well. It's not just an internal threat, but that in this world, in life, there are spiritual forces who are opposed to the church, opposed to God's people. There are people that are opposed to the advancement of God's kingdom. There are external forces that are actively opposed to the purposes and the plans of God and the purposes and plans of his church. And though they rage, God's stability transcends that rage. That God's stability is true. And too often I think we read about these nations that the psalmist talks about. And yeah, nations are mad at Israel. And it just becomes a bit of this like, yeah, okay, that's what happens. But if we think about what he's writing, like there are people who want to kill them. They want to kill their children. Like it's horrendous stuff. Like the reality of what he's scared of is really real. It's probably more extreme than anything any of us are actually going through. Because it's actually life and death. It's complete livelihood, the future of our hopes and dreams and children. And yet, they begin this with a declaration of who God is and what he's like. And the next line of the psalm is just one of my absolute favorites. And it switches tones in many ways. He utters his voice and the earth melts. God's getting involved. And I don't know what you think of when you read utters. To me, and I'm probably wrong in this, I always thought like utters is this like low kind of mumble. It doesn't seem like massive to me. And yet you could translate utters as thunders. That the voice of God thunders on this issue and the earth completely melts. That the earth and all of its strength just dissipates before true strength. It just melts away by the thundering of God's declaration. And we don't know exactly what he says. I think it's probably what he says in verse 10. But all of the forces of chaos and all of the raging nations that are coming against the people and all human leaders who oppose God just melt beneath his thundering voice. Oh man, I need a bigger view of God. That when he speaks and when he thunders and when he declares, all powers just melt away. And he concludes this section with a response that God is with us. That God is our fortress. Which is amazing. And then we move into the third scene, which is God's powerful response. And when God speaks, the psalmist is calling everyone, come on, let's watch what he's going to do. Behold, it says, let's come and see God moving in our midst. Let's come and see that God is going to act for us and defend us. And it's going to be amazing and it's going to be awe-inspiring. It's an act of worship to watch God rise up and defend his people. And I see this progression of Psalms. That it starts with the waters are chaotic. The waters are rising, and God doesn't act immediately. That sometimes he lets the waters get super high. He lets it get up to our nostrils where we can't think, if this keeps going, I'm actually going to die. If this keeps going, I won't be able to breathe. And the reality is, I hate it that he does it. I genuinely don't like that he lets the waters get that high, but we have to trust it. But now, Israel's whole world is crumbling apart. The psalmist internally, externally, feels like everything is coming apart at its seams, and he is about to do something, and let's just embrace it, and let's just watch it, and let's just worship his goodness. And it goes on to describe what he's going to do, and there is like end times implications in this, but all scholars kind of think there's an immediate response as well. And basically, God is saying, I'm actually going to come and I'm going to wage war on war itself. I'm going to go to war against chaos. And he doesn't just go to war against war, but he is going to utterly obliterate the means of war. That he destroys every ability for the enemies of Israel to even continue and to engage in war. That he is going to wage war so that his peace brings out a complete end to war itself. That the chaos and the adversity is completely obliterated. And lastly, verse 10, which is a famous verse, and oddly enough, the Facebook post that prompted this sermon, he says, "Be still and know that I am God," which is really nice and calming. But there isn't anything calm about this psalm, especially this section of the psalm. God is waging war on war. He is bringing about his justice and his judgment against everything and anyone that opposes him. That God is on the move. God is triumphing. God is waging war on war itself. And it's something worth worshiping and it's something worth beholding, but it doesn't seem calm to me. Be still and know that I'm God. And the Biblical Studies Facebook post that I read said it's actually a better translation to read it as sink down and know that I am God. Which you go, am I being told to sink down? Is he talking to me? Is he talking to you? Is he talking to the Israelites? And commentators actually don't think he's talking to people at all. And so sorry for anyone who has a be still and know that I'm God piece of wood hanging in their living room. They actually don't think this is for us at all. And though the idea isn't wrong, it's not what's happening here. That this is a declaration from the sovereign king, ruler of heaven and earth, against the forces of chaos, against the waters we read about in the first part, to sink down, go back to where you came, and stop bringing chaos against my people. That this is a sovereign declaration showing his lordship and showing his power and his might, and he declares all of evil and all of the forces of chaos and all adversity that stand against his people, that stand against his purpose, that stand against his church, and he says, sink back down to where you came from. He's talking about the waters that are trying to topple Zion. Sink down. Sink down and know that I will be exalted amongst all nations, that I'll be exalted over all the earth. It's a declaration of his authority. It's a declaration of his rulership, which in my opinion is a far greater read than just telling me to sit still. That he is the Lord over all things, that he is arisen, that he is engaged, and he's completely putting an end to chaos. That he's putting an end to the evil forces that are opposed to him and opposed to his people. And in my own life, I can feel this chaos internally, what's going on inside me, but the reality is I can feel chaos coming against me and against our church and against the mission of God. And this psalm is both impacted my view of what's happening, but it's impacted my prayer life as well. It has made me look to him in a different way when the waters at times have felt like they're right up to my nose, where it feels like if it gets any worse, I'm actually not going to be able to bear it. And everything I have depended on, everything I have looked to has been covered by water, has been covered by chaos, and I feel so unstable on my own. I feel him urging, come and watch. Come and see what I'm going to do. I feel him inviting me into trust anew, that though waters are raging and though things may feel terrible, I am secure in him, that his mountain will not be shaken. He's not going to leave his dwelling place, that he is in the midst of his dwelling place, and from him comes waters of life that bring peace and joy. That his promise is that he dwells in the city of God, and those in the city of God will be made glad. And this psalm, it doesn't downplay the reality of evil, and it doesn't downplay the reality of attack and the reality of the adversity of life, but it gives us perspective. We're not made to think that the waters up to our noses is something rare. The reality is probably the rest of our lives we'll have this sense of adversity is always coming. Life can always feel difficult, and yet the perspective is that there is one mountain that will never be shaken. There is one mountain in which I can find the fullness of refuge. And other stabilities cannot and will not stand. And so I feel him going, Stephen, where have you put your hope in other mountains, other forms of stabilities that are inevitably going to get tossed into the sea? Like my story earlier, where have I put faith in a house, in a job, in families, in leaders? What outside of Christ have I looked to provide ultimate stability? And the reality is, adversity is terrible. And the waters feel up to my nose. But he's going, no, trust in me, Stephen. I am your refuge. I am your strength. I am unmovable. He's saying, I have rivers that flow from me, from my holy temple, that will nourish you, that will sustain you, that will give you everything you need, that will give you hope and joy, even though there's chaos reigning all around you. And like I said, verse 8 is just resonating in my heart that God is in some ways inviting us to come and watch what I'm going to do. I've let chaos get this high, but come and watch how good I am. Come and watch my strength. Come and watch my power. Why don't you come and see what true refuge looks like? And I can feel within me this hope arising. I can feel it personally for my own life, my own calling, but I can feel it over our church. I can feel him saying, come on, Stephen, come and watch what I'm going to do in this place. And I can feel peace coming despite my circumstances, despite real and significant chaos, internal chaos, external chaos, real suffering and real pain. And I can feel the coming thunder and his thunderous declaration that chaos and evil will be told what to do and where to go. They will be told, sink down. Go back from where you came and recognize the sovereignty and the power and the might of God. And it's shaped my prayers. So I think the idea of be still that we've understood is not a wrong idea that we can trust, and it's not about our works. I don't think that's a wrong reading, but I think it misses the sovereignty of God. And my prayer has just been, Jesus, you alone are Lord. That you actually rule over all of heaven, you rule over all of earth, and everything within you are Lord over. And I need you, we need you, this church needs you, that we need your thunderous voice and your might. And the psalmists often just call out for God, rise up. And I'm joining them and going, rise up, God. You have let in your providence the waters get really high. But rise up. Defend us. Wage war against the war that's killing me. Wage war against the war that's killing us. Be exalted in my life. Be exalted in this church. Be exalted in this city. And let us come and see your goodness once again. Let us come and see your miraculous once again. Let's come and see your sovereign hand move in power once again. Let us experience and know afresh your refuge. Let us know afresh your safety, your strength, your peace, and your joy. And church, I feel him urging me and likely you to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Christ is our foundation, that he is a mountain that's unshakable and a mountain that can't be moved, that he has you, he has me, he has all of us, that he is not going to leave us, but he dwells in the midst of us and brings peace, and he brings life, and he brings refreshing, and he brings joy. And as the New Testament says, the gates of hell will not prevail against her. That he assures us of victory, that he assures us of peace and life amid the chaos of this world. But he's urging me, stop looking at the waters of chaos and start looking to my waters of life. Start looking to my waters of peace. So I implore you to put your hope and put your trust and to put your life and to put your calling and in some ways the corporate calling of this church on the true mountain. That there is one mountain that will not be toppled. There is one foundation that will not be broken, and that is Jesus Christ. And amidst the trial, drink in his waters of life. Run to him. Run to his peace. Run and receive afresh of his joy. And his promise is that he will make his people glad. Amen. Bishop Todd.